Okay, I'd like to open this debate. Is that audible to everybody? Good. My name is John Brearley. I'm the Professor of Nationalism here at LSE. I'm chairing this debate on the book by Michael Mann, The Dark Side of Democracy, Explaining Ethnic Cleansing. Let me just outline the format of this debate so everybody knows how it will be organised. As chair, I will make an opening statement to introduce the book by Michael Mann. It is a long and complex book, and I don't imagine everybody has read it all through carefully, and that in a sense will be the purpose of that will be to simply situate the book for the debate. I will then invite the three participants other than Michael Mann to make statements about the book relating these to their particular interests. That is David Cesarani, who at the moment we understand is caught in traffic on his way from Royal Holloway College, Benjamin Neuberger and Sinisar Melesevic. I'll introduce them more properly at a later stage. I will then ask McMahon to respond to those various statements. And then in the time remaining, we'll ask for questions, comments from the audience and responses from the debate participants. We need to finish at about 7 o'clock. So that's basically how it's organised. Let me just say a few words about this book, Dark Side of Democracy. Consists of some 17 chapters. The first sets out the principal arguments or theses of the book. The next two consider historical background. The following 14 look at a range of cases relating the detailed analysis of these to the opening arguments. Chapter 16 looks at what are called counterfactual cases, India and Indonesia, where there had not been genocides. And then finally, the last chapter reflects on the previous arguments to discuss combating ethnic cleansing in the world today. It's based on very wide and very deep reading, also in some cases some original research, especially in relation to the Nazi perpetrators. It is very complex and it is very long. The argument begins by, incidentally, if I get something wrong here, I think there's somebody who is capable of putting me right, even if we do believe in the death of the author thesis. Sets out 8 theses. First of all, that there is a link between democracy and ethnic cleansing, or rather perhaps between stalled or failed democracies, democratization and genocide. In many ways, the key to the title of the book. The second is that in cases of genocide, ethnicity trumps, but does not necessarily eliminate, divisions by class. The third is that in genocide cases, one finds two groups with conflicting claims, above all over political power, but other matters too. The fourth specifies, deals with the conditions under which these two sides will decide to move to violence in their conflict, whether the weaker or the stronger party initiates that violence. The fifth suggests that a key accompanying factor is an unstable and factionalised state radicalised by crisis, usually in the context of war, either interstate or civil. The sixth suggests that genocide is not a long, deliberate, intended plan, but arises out of a series of steps that finally end up at that. The seventh suggests the need to distinguish between elites, militants, and core constituencies in understanding how genocide is carried out. And the eighth thesis considers how ordinary people are brought in by normal social structures, usually with a range of mundane motives. It's not a simple case of applying these theses, but rather careful analysis in relation to these and coming back to ask how far they relate to the particular cases. There's also a need, which then is the rest of the introduction, to define key terms such as ethnicity, genocide, to create a typology of types of conflict and violence, of which genocide forms a part, to consider target groups other than ethnic ones for genocide, for example, a political class or an alleged class enemy. Michael Mann situates his own approach within what might be called the categories of the social and the modernist. The key point, I think, on the social is the notion of social or institutional cages which create a series of steps that can culminate in genocide. Modernist, I think, I'll come back to in a moment. And finally, Michael Mann links this analysis to the four types of power that he distinguished in his important volume Sources of Social Power: political, economic, ideological, military, seeing the economic in many ways as the least important. The military is usually providing a key context and method, but great stress is laid upon the political and ideological. The background chapters. Chapter 2 is largely negative, trying to make the case that reports of pre-modern mass killings cannot really be called genocide. They take place in what Giddens called class-divided societies, where people, insofar as they have ethnic identities, have what might be called micro rather than macro ethnic. At best, they are exemplary killings designed to deter others from resistance. Although one can sometimes get more broadly based killings based on religious affiliations. Chapter 3, continuing the background, is on how we the people, the key phrase in the American and French revolutions, turned in the 19th century into we the ethnos, especially in Central Europe, and by post-1918 conditions for ethno-nationalism created with a formation of a series of nation states with a dominant ethnic nationality, but as yet not systematic ethnic killing. Chapter 4 considers what Michael Mann considers to be the first modern genocides, those perpetrated by white settlers on indigenous populations. And he takes the cases of North America, Caucasus, Tasmania, Southwest Africa, especially important where settlers wanted land for themselves, an economic concern, but also important roles for ideology, race ideology, for example, and the military. Chapters 5 to 15 are the heart of the book, I think, and consider some 8 cases: Armenia, the genocides of the Third Reich and its allies, the communist mass murders under Stalin, Mao Zedong, and Pol Pot, ethnic cleansing in former Yugoslavia, and finally, the genocide in Rwanda. Far too much to paraphrase. The chapters consider approaches to genocide and then the actual carrying out of genocide. I'll just make some very brief points, really questions, perhaps that Mick himself might consider in relation to the 8 theses and some other points that I think are particularly interesting. To come back to the 8 theses, first of all, the link between democracy and ethnic cleansing, or between stalled democratisation processes, perhaps, and failed democracy and ethnic cleansing. It seems to me that on the basis of his own analysis, one can say yes in relation to settled democracy, to Germany, to Yugoslavia, to Rwanda, but not so obviously yes, perhaps even no, to the communist cases and Armenia. And a lot is dependent on precisely what means by democracy and failed democracy. On the second thesis, that ethnicity trumps but does not eliminate class, well, this can mean that there are either ethnic class links in the actual genocides, or that there were class characteristics, for example, to the perpetrators. If we take the former, it seems to me again that one can say yes in the case of Rwanda and the communist cases, but it's less clear elsewhere. And with perpetrators, as his own analysis shows, other factors such as gender, age, occupation are as, if not more, important than class. In terms of the third thesis, two groups, conflicting claims, above all over political power, it seems to me that one can say yes for Yugoslavia, probably more than two groups, for settlers, for Rwanda, to some extent for Nazi allies, but not in any objective sense for Germany, the communist cases in Armenia, unless one says the Jews are a threat, for example, because Hitler believes they are. As for the fourth thesis, when two sides will fight, well, it can only apply when the answer to the third thesis is yes. For the unstable, factionalized state, the problem, of course, is when one describes a state as unstable and factionalized. For example, I would describe the Third Reich from 1939 as factionalized, but not in any common sense meaning of the word, as unstable. Clearly, however, with Rwanda, Turkey, Yugoslavia, it seems more applicable. Also important is the context of war, which seems to apply to all the cases with the exception of China, USSR, and the settler societies, although the killings themselves there were part of an intense and violent conflict. As part of a long-intended plan, I think Michael Mann's analysis suggests this is the one universally present feature in all the cases considered. And it clearly links back to the fifth thesis in terms of either state instability or a radicalising process, perhaps accompanied by war. For the seventh thesis about the involvement of elites, militants, core constituencies, I think this is less a thesis than a way of analysing the processes. The only issue is whether this mode is perhaps, for example, too pluralist in terms of assigning responsibility. And finally, on the ordinary people, again, this is, I think, above all in terms of a mode of analysis and raises, again, important questions that one finds in lots of, particularly the Holocaust studies, about the responsibility, the extent to which ordinary people can be regarded as an agent in the process. Just briefly, some additional points. It seemed to me on reading the book that the German case does still remain unique in the lack of any objective enemy, whether as another mobilised ethnic group or as some class obstacle to a revolutionary or a modernising project. As an historian, I would want to stress what I found the tremendous originality of the material analysis on the Nazi perpetrators, and I think a really original view that emerges distinct from either Goldhagen's thesis of all Germans or Browning's thesis of ordinary people. To sum it up, not ordinary Germans, but ordinary doctors, policemen, engineers. Thirdly, again in relation to the German case, the insistence that this was a violent and passionate process, not a banal or bureaucratic one. With Germany's allies, I think once finds the revival of ethno-nationalism more like some of the other cases. On the communist cases, my question would be, does a class definition of the enemy function like an ethnic definition of the enemy in other cases? Is there a shared dynamic, failed democracy, modernizing rage, revolutionary project, which might bring these together? In the cases of Armenia, Yugoslavia, and Rwanda, there seems to be a particular focus on war zones linked directly to more general war conditions. But then the question is, how and why does the process of murder extend to other zones? And finally, I have a particular interest, as professor of nationalism, in how far the shift from something that McMahon calls pre-modern micro-ethnicity to modern macro-ethnicity actually takes place, whether it's something that takes place slowly in advance of the crisis leading to genocide, or is something which can actually be rapidly constructed through the crisis itself. Chapter 16 deals with the counterfactual cases of India and Indonesia. The most basic point, I think, is that the existence of ethnic cleavages or ethno-religious cleavages, which can generate riots and occasional periods of large-scale violence, for example, the partition crisis of 1947 in India, do not necessarily lead to genocide. So is it a case of specific inhibiting factors, for example, continuing civilian and pluralist politics, effective external intervention or whatever, or rather the absence of precipitating factors of the kind found in the positive cases, for example, badly factionalised and radicalising state in war situation. Reading this chapter, it seems to me war, above all, created the habits and institutions of killing, the shifts of power to military and paramilitary groups, the sealing off of zones from civilian and foreign surveillance, and the radicalisation of sentiment. Chapter 17, concluding chapter, argues rather darkly that successful ethnic cleansing itself removes the basis for future ethnic cleansing. The West shouldn't be too superior about the unlikelihood of ethnic cleansing in this case because it did it earlier. But the question is, what will happen elsewhere? Will it happen where we still have pre-modern polities, micro-ethnicity, significant transnational forces? Are there special cases with potential dangers? For example, where there are conflicts based on fundamentalist religions, both within and between faiths, or in the case of the settler democracy of Israel, or the black hole regions on the fringes, parts of sub-Saharan Africa, Sudan, some areas of the former USSR, but often also a range of countervailing factors. And is Western intervention one such factor, or is it likely to be too little or too late, or even in fact, most terribly of all, a contributory factor? The conclusion is that ethnic cleansing and genocide is associated with the process of becoming modern, but it is not inevitable in the process of becoming modern. To quote from the final paragraph, I think it's best to finish this in McMahon's own words, ethnic cleansing results from one secular trend of modern societies. That is all. The dark side of democracy is passing through modern societies. It has finished passing through the North and is now engulfing parts of the South. But it will end before long when democracy is securely institutionalized in terms appropriate to multi-ethnic and especially bi-ethnic populations. It will hopefully end during the 21st century. By now we can recognize the circumstances in which ethnic cleansing threatens danger and then goes over the brink into mass murder. From recognition comes the ability to formulate solutions. But at present, we lack the will to commit resources to those solutions in the south of the world. The south may be forced to repeat our own doleful history of ethnic cleansing. We will now have to change the original plan. We'll have to move to Plan B, as is so often the case, because David Cesarani is still not here. So I will ask Sinisar Milosevic to make his statement.
Okay, so I've recently written a review of this book where I said basically that it's an excellent book. But since this, the point here is to have a debate, I really have to focus on criticism, some criticism. So before I say, I'll largely focus on three distinct areas. And before I move onto that, I have to say what I like generally about this book. There are many things that I like, but I'll just emphasize one. Okay, so the dark side of democracy, just as much of Michael Mann's work, is characterized by a courageous attempt to achieve something that the most of contemporary sociology has given up on, a universalist explanation. A bold, grand generalizations are today largely detested by both empiricists who focus almost exclusively on very minute areas of study, operating with exceptionally limited but what they consider to be testable claims, and social theorists who have for the most part retreated from the grand theory building towards either the construction and discourse analysis, as in post-structuralism and anti-foundationalism, or inflexible micro-formalism, as in rational choice or game theory models. This state of affairs is partially a direct result of a sharp and often justified criticism of unreflexive and overly ambitious positivist and teleological models that dominated much of sociology in the last two centuries, from Auguste Comte to Talcott Parsons. However, these criticisms were so successful that they have led now to another extreme, where the researchers are reluctant to engage with the big topics, to ask big substantive questions, or to meaningfully link grand social theory with the fastidious comparative empirical work. In other words, although previous criticisms were beneficial in making us more sensitive towards the concepts we use, the models we develop, or the implications of our theoretical and empirical research on a wider society, they've also led towards the contemporary state of explanatory paralysis, where the researchers shy away from these big themes and the generalized modes of explanation. In this context, Michael Mann's work is not only exceptionally brave, but also highly beneficial to sociology and social science at large, as it reiterates the importance of asking grand questions and providing as definite answers as possible within the social sciences using large-scale comparative analysis. And I think Sources of Social Power are very good in that respect, both volumes, as it is the fascist book. The Dark Side of Democracy is also such a book, which tests a number of provocative and generalizing ideas in a context of numerous case studies throughout the history. Mann's general argument about the modernity of systematic mass killings and its deep, but for the most part unrecognized, link with the ideology and processes of democratization is as politically and ethically uncomfortable as it is theoretically and empirically challenging. The fact that ethnic cleansing is not a prerogative of authoritarianism, thus something that happens to deviant and backward others, but rather a profoundly modern phenomenon that occurs in the process of democratization and something that happens as much to the progressive and advanced us, is as morally disturbing as it is sociologically enlightening. This is exactly what good social science should look like, to show us how in the world of human beings very often nothing is as it seems. There is very little room for common sense. Much of sociology really goes very much against the common sense, and no place for intellectual complacency. So good sociology, just as good astronomy, should be a disturbing exercise. It should make us uncomfortable. Otherwise, we would still believe that the Earth is flat, that the sun orbits around it, and the stars are tiny, glittery objects in the sky, just as we would believe in the divine origins of royalty or that witchcraft and shaman spells determine one's human condition. In this respect, Mann's book is an excellent comparative macro-sociology of ethnic cleansing. This is the eulogy part. Now I'll move on to the criticism. However, as any work on such a grand scale, it is prone to conceptual and empirical inaccuracies and occasional simplifications. I will focus here briefly on the three sets of issues that require either more in-depth analysis or clearer conceptual elaboration. First is the macro-sociology of ethnicity. Then the second is the position of ethno-nationalism in the state socialist world. And finally is the complex nature of Yugoslav case, particularly the nature of Yugoslav federalism. So first, let's focus on this issue of ethnicity, the conceptual issues. While Mann is, together with Randall Collins, perhaps the most Weberian of contemporary macro-sociologists of ethnicity, his understanding of cultural difference at the micro level is still too static when compared to Weber's original position. While he rightly acknowledges the often subjective nature of ethnic group membership, particularly defined by vague or fictitious notions of common culture and descent, he still operates with the group-centric view of ethnicity. As he puts it, quote, an ethnicity is a group that defines itself or is defined by others as sharing common descent and culture. In this perspective, ethnicity is still understood as a collective asset of a particular group rather than an aspect of social relationship between individuals and groups. Such a conceptualization of ethnicity occasionally leads Mann to implicit reification of group membership when he writes, quote, about Greeks and Turks as being cosmopolitan peoples living in a multicultural environments, or about ethnic groups lacking or aiming to achieve their own states instead of obviously social movements or political elites representing or making that sort of claim. So in some sense, the micro-sociology is not dynamic enough. It's still seen in more static terms as a category, relatively fixed. So what is missing here is the dynamics of the micro-social world, the fuzziness of group interactions, the ongoing transformation of collective perceptions, the subtle social categorizations, and the analysis of social action in general. Whereas Mann does clearly identify concrete social agents whose action determines the direction of ethnic cleansing, such as radicalized political elites, paramilitary thugs, core constituencies of ethno-nationalism, and ordinary perpetrators of mass killings, they are rather static and mostly one-dimensional as being shaped by the sudden historical and geopolitical transformations. Despite his open preference for non-essentialist concepts and his criticism of those who treat ethnic collectivities and nations as singular actors, this non-essentialist commitment is less visible in some of his analysis of the case studies. In this respect, unlike his macro-sociology of power, which is firmly Weberian and very good in that respect, his micro-sociology of ethnicity is significantly less Weberian, since Weber saw ethnic groups as amorphous entities whose formation is almost entirely dependent on social action. Weber rightly argued that ethnic collectivities are quasi-groups, grounded in a particular belief in common descent, which becomes socially meaningful only through collective, mostly political action. However, more problematic in this context is Mann's exceptionally wide and unusually trans-historical understanding of class relations. This view regularly subsumes many forms of non-ethnic associations, such as status, estates, or caste-based institutions under the concept of class. So we can read, quote, about class conscious rules of medieval warfare, or about class divisions in medieval Europe, where, quote, religion widened the cultural gulf between classes, or about Indian caste system as a variant of his thesis on ethnicity trumping class as the main form of social stratification. There are no clear distinctions here between utterly immobile forms of status or estate-like membership entrenched in profound and for the most part unchangeable cultural identities that characterized medieval world of Europe, from much more economic and thus more open and market-dependent class associations that one encounters in modernity. Not only that, classes are in many respects modern forms of association, including their specific market condition, the greater importance of consumption and the sense of class identity, but they are also more fluid forms of group attachment than the caste or estate. As Weber rightly points out, classes too are quasi-groups who consist of individuals sharing a similar market situation. So Mann's micro-sociology of ethnicity requires much more fine-tuning to be as good as his macro-sociology of ethnicity. The second issue is it's one I won't devote that much time on, is this relation between ethno-nationalism and communist states. The fact that communist cleansing receives less attention in Mann's book than one would expect is less of a problem per se, as this makes sense within his conceptual model that distinguishes between politicized, fratricide, and ethnic cleansing. However, what needs more analytical clarification is his strong distinction between classicide and genocide. This problem is again linked to his very firm conceptual apparatus that conceives of classes and ethnic groups as a very stable and bounded entities that have almost nothing in common, rather than viewing them as open processual categories of practice which can occasionally also overlap. As a result, he makes strong claims such as that, quote, Marxist generated an organic view of the people defined not by ethnicity but by class, or that, quote, communist version of rule by the people, however flawed in other ways, was transnational. This is illustrated by Stalinist obsession with the extermination of kulaks as a social class, an economic category, rather than as a set of culturally or politically distinct individuals. However, the story is more complicated than this, as the relationship between class and ethnicity in the communist world was much more ambiguous and less clear-cut than suggested by Mann. As I have argued elsewhere, especially in my book Ideology, Legitimacy, and the New State, there is an important distinction between the normative or official ideological narrative of the particular political order and its operative, that is, institutionalized counterpart. While communist states have, for the most part, preached proletarian internationalism on the normative level, nationalism, and especially ethno-nationalism, again, depending on individual states, was a cornerstone of their operative ideology and an important source of internal legitimacy. Again, this differs in different historical phases. This is particularly visible in different normative and operative depictions of dominant social actors as popularly unrecognizable abstract class enemies, such as bourgeoisie or capitalist or whatever, who are often on the operative level portrayed as highly recognizable ethno-national enemies that threaten our country. So at the same time, the universal notion of transnational working class or working people that features prominently in the normative ideology and its operative counterpart becomes transformed into our heroic or chosen people. So just basically an example, instead of this universalist, transnational, in some respects maybe transhistorical concept of the working class that we encounter in German ideology, which is usually copied onto political manifestos of all communist parties, in operative ideology, in the mass media, in the school textbooks, this is translated really into a heroic chosen people. So instead of universal worker, we end up with having a brave Romanians or Russians or whoever. So instead of abstract egoistic bourgeoisie, one encounters concrete physical threat represented in the form of the British or American nations and their representatives, imperialist spies or traitors and so on. So thus, in this context, kulaks were not only defined as a class enemy, but also as an ethno-national enemy, an enemy of the Russian people. As Mann himself puts it, quote, they were leeches and vampires sucking the blood from the Russian people. What is important here is that it is only when kulaks are portrayed as ethno-national enemy that rulers can mobilize mass support. The rulers thrive on this ambiguity of treason and spying and all this stuff, which paints kulaks as simultaneously non-proletarian and non-patriotic. So Mann is absolutely right that these regimes cultivated an organic conception of we the people, but this was never linked to class only, as ethno-national images always lurked in the background. So that's very brief on that. And finally, I'll focus a little bit on the Yugoslav case. And here, Mann devotes two chapters to explaining the origins of ethnic cleansing in the Yugoslav context. His second chapter, which is a longer one, which deals with the really mechanisms and specifics of ethnic cleansing, is very good, I think. I don't really have much to say about that. But the first chapter, I think, has some inaccuracies and things to deal with. So Mann's explanation of the ethnic cleansing in the wars of Yugoslav succession is for the most part illuminating and accurate. He identifies the mechanisms of ethnic mobilization, the impact of geopolitical changes, the responsibility of political elites, paramilitary organizations, and the core supporters of the ethno-nationalist projects. He also, on the whole, successfully explains the behavior of ordinary Yugoslav citizens. However, what needs much more clarification is the complex relationship between the party and the state in the federal structure of the communist Yugoslavia, as this is crucial in understanding the origins of the conflict. Here, too, one needs more engagement with the internal microcosms of this phenomenon or the tragedy. So in Mann's analysis, communist Yugoslavia looks inaccurately too much like its monarchist predecessor, where he puts it, quote, Serbs were the local imperial nation having formed the first independent state and leading both interwar and Titoist Yugoslavia, or that in both states the Serb nation had been privileged. What is missing here is the understanding of the changing nature of Yugoslav federalism in the periods between 1945 and 1991, tremendous changes, which have direct implications of what was to happen later on. So while until 1948, 49, in the final breakup with the Soviet Union, Yugoslav federal structure was in many respects a carbon copy of the 1936 Soviet model, Soviet constitution, where individual republics held little real political autonomy. The state has gradually evolved, eventually dramatically changed, so that by the 1980s, the republics had an unprecedented degree of self-rule, and the real rule, not just one on the paper as we would encounter in the Soviet Union. From the 1953 constitutional law, which decentralized economy, media, and education policy, to constitutional amendments of the 60s, which gave even more authority to the republics and provinces, to the 1974 constitution, when for the first time sovereignty was deduced from the individual republics rather than the federation, which was the case before. So sovereignty was located in the republics. Yugoslav state went through exceptional change from largely centralized state to quasi-confederal structure. With the introduction of the 1974 constitution, the republics, or more precisely communist party leaderships of individual republics, rather than federal center, made decisions on most essential policies such as economy, finances, distribution of public funds, policing, civil protection, defense, which in many respects were as important as the army, and the law, jurisprudence. This is particularly important when one considers the conflicting relationship between the party and the state in Yugoslav federalism. So Mann's analysis is too externalized, as it pays no attention to this internal relationship, which was decisive for the state's breakup. Since Yugoslav state was an ideocracy, initially the power was almost solely located within the party, not the state. In this respect, what mattered was not how many ordinary Serbs were in the military or police, as Mann emphasizes, but rather who was on the central committee of the League of Communists of Yugoslavia, where the power was located. It didn't really matter whether you were ordinary conscript or a policeman on the street. You didn't really have much power. However, the decentralization of the state, together with gradual but still rather slow radiation of power from the party to the state structure, came in a direct collision with the centralized nature of the party. As Bilandžić and a few other analysts in the 80s have predicted well, changing the principle of organization for one, that is the state, decentralizing the state dramatically, and not for the other, the party, which attempted to preserve the idea of democratic centralism, would create a situation where one would break up the other. So that actually is what happened. The party broke up the state, and that happened in the 80s, not in the 90s. And that is exactly what happened in the 80s, as the unprecedented decentralization of the state produced a quasi-multi-party system, with eight communist party organizations having virtual monopoly over their respective territories and competing over the federal center. Hence, the problem was not so much in the essentially sounding Serb domination, as implied. Here, it was the peculiar character of the federal state which created conditions for future ethno-national homogenization. So to maintain its political monopoly, the party attempted to deal with the accumulated differences and existing antagonisms by shifting the emphasis from the crucial issue of popular participation towards the question of territorial organization. So the party state attempted to weigh the genuine democratization and liberalization by articulating them as questions of decentralization. So the federal center was forced to choose between devolving a power to its citizens, which is really in some ways democratization, or to party leaderships of individual republics, which is decentralization, and it has opted for the latter. So it was this ad hoc strategy for decreasing the pressure from below, which was a prelude for the state's breakup, creating conditions where party apparatchiks relying on already existing and exceptionally decentralized state structures aiming to maintain or widen their support base could easily switch from civic pan-Yugoslav to ethnic forms of group solidarity. So Mann, I think, underestimates the importance of these complex relationships between the party and the state, as well as their institutional legacy. It is the remnants of this communist federal state's administrative apparatus that were essential in the formation of Serb autonomous regions, SAO, municipal coalitions, which were created in the early 90s out of fragments of the local state structure, with the crisis committees, or krizni štabovi, as the most important vehicle of ethnic cleansing. It is the legacy of the communist state, more than anything else, that created the institutional conditions for mass-scale violence, which was soon to follow. It did not necessarily have to lead in that direction, but the institutions were useful for this to happen. So Mann is right that democratization and the changing nature of geopolitics have intensified conflicts in the direction of ethnic cleansing, but the origins of these antagonisms and the technology have to be traced in a highly distinctive and contradictory nature of the Yugoslav federalism. So to sum up very briefly, The Dark Side of Democracy is an extremely valuable book. It provides us with a powerful universalist explanation that links modernity and democratization with the increase in mass-scale violence. And unfortunately, I couldn't really talk about the good sides of the book, which I really like. I wanted to intentionally focus on a few of these problems. It also offers formidable macro-sociology of ethnic cleansing, able to make sense of enormous diversity of historical cases. In that respect, it's an exceptional piece of work. However, the micro-sociology, as well as the non-externalized aspects of explanation, are much less developed and would require more subtlety if one is to achieve a fully-fledged account of such a complex phenomenon that is ethnic cleansing. Thanks.
Thank you. Instantly, my apologies to Sinisar Milosevic. I forgot to introduce him properly to you. At University College Galway, a specialist in the field of modern Yugoslavia and the study of ethnicity, as you would have gathered, and recent book publications include Ideology, Legitimacy and the New State, Yugoslavia, Serbia and Croatia, and a book, The Sociology of Ethnicity. I'm very relieved to notice that David Cesarani has now arrived, and I would like him to, perhaps he could at this point, come up. And maybe if you could make the next statement, if you're ready.
Sure.
If I could just briefly introduce David Cesarani, Royal Holloway, University of London, a specialist in the field of modern Jewish and Holocaust studies. Recent book publications include a study of Eichmann, 2004, and he was editor of a six-volume collection called Critical Concepts, The Holocaust, which was published also in 2004. So, over to you.
Thank you very much for that introduction, John, and I apologise for disrupting your carefully orchestrated lineup for this event. I should also thank my wife, who got a message to John via several intermediaries, I think, to explain that I was stuck on the M25. This is a result of having moved from Southampton to Royal Holloway. Going between London and Southampton, I had, after 7 years, mastered the vagaries of southwest trains. When it comes to the motorway system, the N25 in particular, I am an ingenue, and I really got caught out this afternoon. But I am very glad that I made it, because I'm delighted to be able to take part in this discussion of Michael's book, which I want to begin by commending for its ambition and for the sheer industry of Michael's project. It's a daunting read in many ways, but the results are truly impressive. And I want to begin by addressing the area about which I can claim to have some knowledge. I wouldn't necessarily say expertise, and to signal my concurrence with much of what Michael has to say in his theses about ethnic cleansing, particularly as they pertain to National Socialism and the Third Reich. And what I'll have to say now draws on my work on the Third Reich on an Adolf Eichmann, for which I do not claim any great originality. I'll be drawing on the work of many other scholars. And then I'll move on to say, make a few more general points, at which point when I will be really shooting from the hip. I mean, having just heard our previous speaker, I am kind of in awe of his depth of knowledge, but nevertheless, ignorance has never stopped me from opening my mouth before, and I'm not going to let it today. First of all, I want to signal my concurrence with Michael's view that ethnic cleansing and genocide are modern, that they belong to our civilization, that they cannot be dismissed as primitive. And it is quite interesting if you look at the early historiography of Nazism and the Third Reich, just how often it is characterized as barbaric, medieval, a throwback to savage and primitive times, very much a reflection of the Third Reich's activities in the realm of ethnic, what we now call ethnic cleansing and, of course, genocide. Also, his thesis that ethnic cleansing and genocide are not just committed at the behest of elites, at the head of top-down power structures, although again, if you look at the early history of the Third Reich, that is exactly how Nazi atrocities, mass murder, what we call ethnic cleansing, are depicted. And nor is it the result of pathologies amongst criminal cliques or spontaneous outbursts by frenzied masses. And again, until fairly recently, the notion that the Third Reich was a criminal enterprise dominated by madmen was a very common explanatory device. More recently, we're confronted by, in a sense, the negative of that, the Goldhagen thesis, whereby the German population are frenzied killers just waiting to have the start button pushed by a leader, by a regime, and this murderous frenzy then almost takes its own course. So here you have two extremes, both of which I think are wrong, both of which I think are wonderfully disproved by Michael's work. I agree that ethnic cleansing and genocide cannot be attributed simply to inhuman strategies of totalitarian authoritarian systems, which are set to generate the right type of robot killer, and I'll come to the idea of the robot killer a bit later on in more detail. I think by focusing on democracy, a certain notion of democracy, Michael issues a challenge to all of those who cling to the comforting myth that atrocity, mass murder, genocide can be located in the totalitarian, authoritarian camp, of which Nazi Germany is the prime example, and depending on your ideological point of view, Soviet Union and Stalinism the other prime example. And finally, I agree with him that the perpetrators of ethnic cleansing and genocide are ordinary people, people like us. I suspect that I was invited to take part in this discussion because this is pretty much where my book on Eichmann ends. As I say of Eichmann, he was not born to kill. He wasn't a hardwired murderer, nor was he a foaming-at-the-mouth maniac, much to the disappointment of many people who attended his trial, who, when he walked into the famous courtroom in Jerusalem, a converted theatre, were quite disappointed to find a rather ordinary, middle-aged, balding gentleman with spectacles. They wanted someone with horns or claws or blood trickling from his mouth. Some people expected that kind of anticlimax. Incidentally, Simon Wiesenthal knew that the sight of the present-day Eichmann would disappoint people, so recommended that he be forced to sit in his box during the trial, dressed in his SS uniform, so as to convey the evil of that insignia and to remind people of what he had been at the height of his power. But that would have been literally to disguise the ordinariness of the man and the ordinariness of most killers, and to avoid the uncomfortable truth, which I think Michael demonstrates very well, that those who get sucked into genocide tend to be rather normal people like us. People who are not simply obeying orders, people who are not in rigid totalitarian state structures. As I write about Eichmann, he was taught to hate, he learned how to practice genocide, and he chose to commit it. We have a legacy from Hannah Arendt about Eichmann, that he was just a sort of rather banal little man, a clerk, a bureaucrat, who was obeying orders, but more important than that, was obeying orders within a totalitarian system. And many people who quote Hannah Arendt on Eichmann and on genocidal killers in his mould forget that she went to Jerusalem, metaphorically, with the origins of totalitarianism in her back pocket, and that she wanted to find someone on trial who would conform to her theory. She didn't actually stay for the whole trial. She didn't see very much of Eichmann's testimony. At the most, I think she must have seen him speaking for 2, maybe 3 days. Now, the rest of the time she was getting reports secondhand. All she had seen is this chap sitting very, very quietly and deliberately, unemotionally, in his witness box, trying not to appear angry or evil, because, as his lawyer said, that wouldn't do him very much good. And this was what she wanted. This was the classic totalitarian man, the man who did his duty, was obedient, and who was able to commit what in ordinary, normal circumstances would be considered wrong, illegal acts, or, to use that metaphorical term, evil acts, because he was operating within a totalitarian system in which right and wrong had been not simply undermined, but inverted. And that is crucial, I think, to understanding her theorization of Eichmann and the understanding of totalitarian regimes, their capacity for inverting right and wrong, so that normal, obedient people, people who aspire to be good citizens, become practitioners of atrocity and mass murder. The trouble with the thesis is that the Third Reich wasn't exactly like that. There was tremendous room for autonomy for various agencies of the state, for individuals operating within them, that there was always there were always residues of opposition. The notion of right and wrong, as had pertained before January 1933, had not been erased, nor was the propaganda machine so totally thorough as to have brainwashed people to be unable to distinguish right from wrong. On the contrary, Eichmann knew that he was doing wrong, but he chose to do wrong. And the question we have to ask is why he and lots of other ordinary Germans and people allied with them, collaborating with them, chose to do what they knew was wrong. And I think there are some significant answers to that question why in Michael's book. One reason, I think, is another one of his theses, that ethnic cleansing and genocide are very often not the intended solution to the so-called problem, demographic, political, economic problem, but the result of block strategies and the frustration of previous policy. When Eichmann was put on trial, not only was the Third Reich conceived of as an entirely top-down state structure in which power flowed from the top to the bottom, as a structure staffed by obedient minions, but that policy unfolded in a linear fashion, that it was fully formed and conceived in the minds of the leadership, notably Adolf Hitler, and then rolled out and implemented in a simplistic sense. We now understand that there was a twisted road to Auschwitz, and that, as Michael explains, not only in the case of the Third Reich, but repeatedly, regimes go through Plan A, Plan B, Plan C, Plan D, until they finally arrive, unintentionally, at ethnic cleansing and also possibly genocide. And I think in this connection, there's some rather interesting work by Benjamin Valentino in a book called Final Solution. It's not a book that I would endorse in its entirety by any means, but I will return to it because I think Valentino is very good on the way in which ethnic cleansing, genocide, and what he calls mass killing are solutions into which regimes, parties, states stumble. And the people who end up enacting them find almost their own surprise that is what they are doing. It's possible for them to do it, and I'll say something more about this, because of previous indoctrination, brutalization processes, which Michael explicates. But I think one reason why the Eichmanns and many other ordinary people end up as part of genocidal machines is that they don't sign up for genocide in the first place, that they become involved in it step by step by step. It's an incremental process, which is, as we now know, equally important to understanding the reaction of so-called victims as it is to the perpetrators. Now, having said how much I agree with those parts of Michael's book, I want to take issue with some of his analysis of National Socialism and ethnic cleansing and genocide as practiced by the Nazis. First of all, I think he overplays the irrationality and the cost of genocide as practiced by the Third Reich. In fact, the so-called final solution, the Jewish question, the mass murder of the Jews, consumed very few resources. It was, for the most part, self-financing. It turned in a very neat profit for the Third Reich, and historians are beginning to argue contributed greatly to the Nazi war economy. It also had very important subsidiary effects in the areas from which the Jews were deported, via the redistribution of wealth, which in turn locked people into support for either the occupying regime or the regime that was collaborating with or allied to the Third Reich. So, and this is work which has been undertaken particularly by Gertz Ali and Christian Gerlach, and they have published a book recently on the mass murder of the Jews of Hungary. Michael refers to the Hungarian case in the traditional, and I have to say rather old-fashioned sense now, as being a kind of last mad frenzy of murder. I think we can now see the German occupation of Hungary as making military, economic, and political sense, and the deportation of 437,000 Jews in about 8 weeks as being undertaken largely to contribute to the German war effort. Those who could not contribute to the German war effort were murdered in Auschwitz-Birkenau. They were consumed by the final solution. But Hungary was not occupied in order for the final solution to be extended to its territory. I think Michael also overstresses the degree to which the murderous cadres in the Third Reich were selected or self-selected for some particular skills or proclivities or ideological commitment. And here I want to go back to the case of Eichmann. Eichmann's involvement in genocide was something of an accident. When he was on trial in Jerusalem, and he tried to explain how he had, in his terms, blundered into scenes in which Jews were being abused, denied their human and civil rights, then deported and later on murdered. Of course, his interrogators, those who were trying him, found his depiction of his own actions simply unbelievable, but I think he deserves more credit. He didn't join the Nazi Party and the SS because he hated Jews any more than anybody else in his part of Austria disliked Jews. He had plenty of opportunities to join. In fact, he held aloof from the Nazi Party because in his particular part of Austria where he grew up, he was of course born in Germany, in the Rhineland. In his particular part of Austria, the Nazi Party was a joke. The Austrian Nazis were a bit of a rabble, and he felt they were beneath him. It's only once they begin to make electoral breakthroughs, they begin to attract people from the upper reaches of the bourgeoisie, that Eichmann, who's rather a vain man, thinks it's time for him to join them. He then enters the Austrian Legion of the SS in Germany, having after the Austrian SS's, the Austrian Nazi Party is suppressed, and there he gets the usual kind of training and indoctrination. There is no sign that he is specifically drawing from this indoctrination training any messages or any practical skills for tormenting or murdering Jews. He joins the Sicherheitsdienst in 1934. He said by mistake, thinking it was Himmler's bodyguard. I think this is a lie. I don't think he was telling the truth. And it's odd that he wasn't more honest about his reasons for joining the SD, because the SD at the time he joined had absolutely no role in the so-called Jewish question. It had very little to say about Jews at all. When he joined, it didn't even have a Jewish department. So the notion that Eichmann either was selected by the Sicherheitsdienst or selected them because of anti-Semitism, I think simply doesn't work. He learns sophisticated anti-Semitism in the Sicherheitsdienst, and he has a number of very interesting teachers about whom it would be nice to know more. Unfortunately, we know very little about them. And his job becomes emigration, assisting Jews to emigrate from the Third Reich, and then after the annexation of Austria in March 1938, implementing coerced emigration. He becomes an emigration expert. This is a chap who could reel off all of the documents that you would need to emigrate to Bolivia. He could tell you all about how to get to Shanghai. He's not a killer. There is not a hint in his career at this stage, 1937, 38, 39. This is a man who would ever become involved in mass murder. He moves into the business of brutal deportations after the German conquest of Poland, but the people who he is brutally deporting are mainly Poles, not Jews. So again, this is not someone who is selected for his willingness, his ability to deport, uproot, and Jews in vast numbers and in appalling circumstances. After the invasion of the Soviet Union, when mass killing begins, Eichmann is worried that he is about to lose his role and his status within the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, the head office of the SS. Because, as he notes, a new group is coming to the fore. These are the real killers. Although, again, it's difficult to argue that the commanders of the Einsatzgruppen were selected for their ability to commit mass murder. And as Michael notes, many of them couldn't hack it and asked to be transferred or lost their minds as a result. But he was aware that a different group was coming to the fore. He didn't have the skills or the experience for that kind of work. And when he travels in the East and he sees mass murder, he is revolted by it and physically distressed, as he says in an interview he gave to an ex-Nazi in South America when he was free. He went weak at the knees at the sight of mass shootings. So this is not, as I said before, a natural-born killer. This is not someone who adapts easily to mass murder. He actually had to force himself to take part. And I think that one case forces us to be very cautious about the notion that ethnic cleansing and genocide recruits its own practitioners. And here I also want to query Michael's notion that certain professions, and he draws on a huge amount of evidence here, which he analyzes econometrically, to argue that certain professions are associated with ethnic cleansing and genocide. Yes, but I think that in turn may be accidental. I think, of course, police and military units, militias, are going to be used to displace populations. And if you're using police and militia and army units for that purpose, then those the men and, in a few cases, women in those units are going to be overrepresented amongst the ethnic cleansers. But what, let us imagine, if the so-called Madagascar plan in 1940 had come off and Jews had been shipped to Madagascar? Would we now be poring over learned articles about the German Navy and asking what was it that made it possible for naval officers and ratings to take part in this barbaric export of human beings from Europe and their dumping in Madagascar. Similarly, it's only because the Nazis pursued what is sometimes called medicalized killing, stemming from the so-called euthanasia campaign, and because they made fitness for work a criteria for determining who would live and who would die, that doctors and nurses have a prominent role amongst the perpetrators. Again, this is accidental, and if you look at the case of Cambodia, you can see exactly the opposite. At work. It was the doctors and nurses, as well as other professionals in Cambodia, who were targeted by the murderers. So I'm not quite sure whether it is so easy to argue that there is some kind of correlation between certain professions and the practice of ethnic cleansing and genocide. Now I want to end with a few general points. And as I said, here I am shooting from the hip. First of all, I have to agree that there's a connection between ethnic cleansing and political movements that claim to act in the name of the people and in pursuit of sovereignty, political advantage, territory, ethnic racial purity, and material advancement, of course. But I think there's a confusion in Michael's argument between populist movements and democracy as a system of government. Now, European democracies, representative governmental systems, may have presided over ethnic cleansing at a distance, in the case of Britain and its colonies, or the USA and its frontier, but at the sharp end, it was less a case of bodies of people or armies acting in the name of the people than chaotic, anarchic frontier conflict between small bands on either side. And very often there was a lack of any kind of government, representative, democratic, or any form. When democratic government did exercise some kind of influence, it was very often in a restraining role. Also, the notion that conflict was defined by a struggle over inclusion, exclusion from entitlements, which crops up at several stages in his argument, doesn't fit the conditions that the peripheries of empires presided over by a democratic metropolitan homeland. It was often the case at these extremities that there was no entitlement to fight over, just brute control of land and resources. The question of inclusion, exclusion only comes into play when indigenous peoples are finally subdued and they're incorporated within the boundaries of the state, which begins to provide services to those who it is deemed citizens. I also have great reservations regarding the insistence that conflict must be rooted in rivalry for control of the state or a shared territory. At best, many campaigns of ethnic cleansing are waged against populations who occupy only part of a territory, and they rarely lay claim to all of it. I mean, the Rwanda situation, I think, is rather unusual. Experts can correct me, but I think there is a huge difference between secessionism, for example, the Armenian case, and the attempt by a particular ethnic group to dominate an entire territory and thus provoking the ethnic cleansing genocidal backlash. And at worst, the accusation that an ethnic group seeks such domination is sheer fantasy. And the same applies to the myth of outside help. I think in Michael's book, there is a danger of accepting the justifications of the cleansers, seeing the source of conflict as real, the result of actual interactions, rather than as a delusion. And of course, the primary example of this is the case of the Jews, and Michael himself accepts that his theses break down at this point. I'm also concerned by the minimal attention that is paid to the murderous policies of communist regimes. And I'm puzzled by the disproportionate attention lavished on the Nazi case, especially because Michael admits that the Third Reich is a bit of an exception. And I think this may result from a circularity of the argument. If ethnic cleansing is the dark side of democracy, then only democracies can be responsible for ethnic cleansing. Michael's kind of gets the communist regimes not off the hook. That's not the right way of putting it, but he sort of shifts them out of the ballpark by defining them as perverted democracies, not real democracies, so we can ignore them. And I think that is a significant weakness. I also note a couple of absences, and now I will draw to a close. First of all, international law. It's a paradox that ethnic cleansing and genocide escalate in tandem with the development of international law and human rights doctrine. And this is not simply the evolution of international law and human rights doctrine as a reaction to ethnic cleansing. or genocide. Carol Fink, in a very interesting book, Defending the Rights of Others, which explores the evolution of minority rights treaties since the 1870s, notes that there's been a tension since the last quarter of the 19th century between the emergence of new states boasting the privileges of modern sovereignty and the desire of the international community to defend the rights of minorities within those states. International law, Fink notes, turned minorities and even individuals into potential Trojan horses. They were a rebuke to sovereignty, a source of extreme irritation. In fact, minorities were less of a threat in the era before they became the focus of interest of international lawyers and international law, when they could be safely massacred and no one intervened to protect them or to assert any kind of rights that they had. As the interwar period illustrates, irredentist minorities could use the doctrines of minority rights to destabilize governments and act as bridgeheads for external aggression. This meant there was another very good reason for getting rid of them when the chance arose. One reason for the ethnic cleansing of Germans, Volksdeutsch, from Poland and Czechoslovakia after the Second World War is not simply revenge and hatred, but the concern that if, after peace is restored, a regime of international law is re-established and rights of minorities are put in place, then these hated minorities will be more difficult to shift than ever before. So before minorities' treaties are drafted and put in place, it would be better to simply get rid of them. This is a paradox, then, that international law may actually encourage ethnic cleansing. And finally, Michael doesn't examine the effect of guerrilla warfare as an incentive for that ethnic cleansing. And I owe this point to Benjamin Valentino. He observes that once Mao Zedong pronounced the doctrine that the people were the sea in which the guerrillas swam like a fish, he gave regimes engaged in anti-guerrilla warfare a very good reason for draining the sea and seeing civilian population of every age and gender as implicated in opposition. Now, of course, this phenomenon preceded Mao's dictum. I think it's extraordinary in this context that Himmler wrote in his meetings book on the 13th of December 1941 with regard to a meeting with Hitler, Jews to be exterminated as partisans. Since the inception of the Franc-Tireur, going back perhaps to the Napoleonic campaigns in Spain and Russia, as well as the American Civil War, civilian populations have been cleared or relocated to deny succor to combatants. Ethnic cleansing is a military strategy. It was, of course, practiced by the British in South Africa, although it was relatively less murderous, and there are interesting questions to ask why that was the case. That example shows that democracies can be as ruthless in warfare as other forms of government, and I think this would probably be a good place for me to end, because it's a point that I think bolsters Michael's case, and I'd like to end on a positive note about what is, I think, in every way a remarkable book. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can I introduce our next participant, Benjamin Neuberger, Department of Sociology, Open University, specialist interests in African and Israeli politics, and I'm going to find time for this in a moment. Books include National Self-Determination in Post-Colonial Africa and Religion and Democracy in Israel, and in Hebrew, a book whose English title is Rwanda 1994, Genocide in the Land of a Thousand Hills. Benjamin.
Okay, good afternoon. Or good evening already. First of all, I want to say that I enjoyed also the book. I agree with much of it. But as two other speakers, I also disagree with some parts of it. I will focus first on some of the theses in the book and relate to it, If possible, I will relate also to terminology. I have some problem also with the terminology because it's a book. But let's start with the first thesis, which I think is the first important in the book, which says, I quote, murderous cleansing is modern because it is a dark side of democracy. Now, certainly in the book, it doesn't say that democracy always leads to ethnic cleansing, although this, how it is defined, could be defined that way. I would rephrase it and say, murderous cleansing may be modern because it may be the dark side of democracy, because certainly it's not always the side of democracy. I very much agree also that genocide, and by the way, I would have called the book Genocide and not Ethnic Cleansing, but about that maybe we'll talk later. The genocide is not necessarily connected with so-called primitive peoples or with regression to primitive instincts, I'm quoting, or to ancient hatreds. If you take the Rwandan example, for example, certainly it's a relatively new conflict. I wouldn't say the groups are new, but certainly mass killing is basically dates to 1959. The first big mass killing was in 1959, not before that. Now, I also agree that the tyranny of the majority, which we could define as so-called democratic, is a more modern phenomenon, because only in modern times majorities are ruling one way or the other, either as democracies or as tyrannies. And on that, we could go back on the concept of tyranny of majority to John Stuart Mill, to Alexis de Tocqueville. I think also the concept of totalitarianism is relevant here because it's also connected with democracy. I mean, totalitarian dictatorship is a dictatorship which is not indifferent to the masses, which mobilizes the masses, and that makes it different from the older dictatorships. In the book, it is said about communist and Nazi dictatorships that they did emerge out of would-be democratizing contexts which they then exploited. And I completely disagree, and I think Hannah Arendt would have agreed, and not disagree, I agree. Hannah Arendt and Raymond Aron, Karl Dietrich Bracher, or Talmon would have agreed with it. Certainly, once democracy is rule of the people, the question arises, who are the people? And the moment the definition of the people is not all the people, but part of the people, either ethnos or class, as written in the book, or settlers, settler democracy. By the way, I don't agree that Israel belongs to that. That's for another symposium. Or in the latest example, in a fundamentalist kind of regime where we the people are we the religious people. In all these cases, immediately the question arises of exclusion and cleansing, if you want. So in that sense, I think that is the right idea. In Rwanda, certainly the Hutus saw themselves as the people, and only they are the people, and the Tutsi were regarded as foreigners, as invaders, and if they are foreigners, invaders, they can be cleansed or killed. Now, in the book itself, the Tutsi, the Hutu are also presented as a proletarian nation as opposed to the imperial nation, to the domineering nation. Now, here I have a problem, because certainly that's only true until 1959, because only until 1959 did the Tutsi rule the country. In 1994, it was basically a state ruled by the Hutus, and so I don't see any sense in defining the Tutsi as an imperial nation. The Hutu were the big majority, 85%. They regarded themselves as the people, and they regarded it also as a democracy, because they said, anyhow, in a democracy, the majority rules, so a majoritarian democracy is ruled by the Hutu. And this misunderstanding what democracy means, what rule by the people means, can indeed lead, as it led in Rwanda, to genocide. I see in this case very much a similarity to the misunderstanding after World War I what national self-determination means. The East Europeans understood national self-determination with an emphasis on the national, which means national self-determination for the Poles means Poles ruling Poles, but not necessarily democracy, or Hungarians ruling Hungarians. While Woodrow Wilson meant something completely different. His emphasis was on self-determination, on democracy. And from this tragic misunderstanding, much of what developed in Europe later on, I think, has its origin. By the way, there is a beautiful quotation also by Sir Ivor Jennings about that. He said, national self-determination of peoples, wonderful, but the problem is, who are the peoples? And that is very similar to the problem of democracy, that the question arises, who are the people in the concept of government by the people? Now, I also agree very much with the thesis that, and this is still part of thesis number one, that ethnic cleansing is more likely in the process of democratization. I would say democratization and not democracy, that is, which means not in a stable authoritarian regime, and not certainly not in a stable, rooted institutional democracy. That is clear, because in such a democracy, things like that cannot happen. In the context of the democratization, what we have is a thin kind of democracy. Democracy only defined as maybe elections and rule by the majority, not rule of law, not human rights, not legitimacy of opposition. And in such a context of democratization, like we had in Yugoslavia and like we had in Rwanda, and there is a tendency, I think, to mobilize the ethnos or the proletariat or the religious community in order to stay in power or to get into power in an electoral process. And that creates a cycle which can lead to violence and maybe even to genocide. I want to remind here about Jack Snyder's book, From Voting to Violence, Democratization and Nationalist Conflict. And he says, Snyder, a similar thesis, that in the context of democratization, under internal pressure to democratize, which we had in Rwanda, and external pressure to democratize, which we also had in Rwanda, a regime which feels threatened and which has not really democratic values, a democratic ethos, may resort to incitement, to exclusion, and even maybe to ethnic warfare and genocide in order to stay in government. Now, I think that applies very much to Rwanda. That exactly what happened in Rwanda. In 1991, the ruling clique in Rwanda, which were the Hutus from the north, from an area called Gisenyi, the ruling group was basically around the wife of the president, and the group was called the Clan de Madame, the wife and her brothers and other relatives. They felt threatened that in this process of democratization, they may lose power because opposition parties were founded in 1991. And there was this very strong possibility that in really democratic elections, opposition parties will ally themselves with the guerrilla movement, which was mainly Tutsi. I say mainly, it was not only Tutsi, and will come to power. That was a very strong possibility, especially after the Arusha Accord of August 1993 between the rebel movement and the government, the so-called peace accord brokered by other states, by neighboring states, great powers. And that said, the foundation of a transitional government of all political forces where the ruling party will be a minority, and the foundation of a unified army based on the concept that the officer corps will be 50% rebels and 50% the national army. The ruling clique feared, and I think rightly, that they may be deposed out of power, and then they devise a strategy. And by the way, I don't accept that we had a kind of events which escalated into genocide. I think it was a clear-cut strategy that total ethnic warfare and genocide, that is a strategy to prevent this scenario from happening. And the strategy was that in a total ethnic warfare, the Hutu opposition will be forced to side with the government and not with the rebel movement, and that will keep the government in power. And then a policy of incitement for genocide started, and it started well before the genocide. And it was a strategy to induce the Hutu opposition parties to support the government or to split. And this strategy has worked. All the opposition parties split in the middle into a wing which became racist, illiberal, supportive of the government, and later on genocidal, and a wing which remained liberal. The leaders of the liberal wing of these opposition parties, the Liberal Party, Christian Democratic Party, Social Democratic Party, were all liquidated in the first days of the genocide in April 94, in a process which Michael Mann, and I would agree, call politicide, the liquidation of the political elite. That was the first stage of the genocide in Rwanda. The first week was politicide, liquidation of the Tutsi elite and the opposition Hutu elites. The next stage was a pure genocide. 800,000 Tutsi, most of them had nothing to do with the elite. Now, this theory, as I say, is true for Rwanda. I'm not sure that it works in the other cases, Holocaust, Armenia, Cambodia, certainly not in the colonial cases. Now I want to switch to thesis number two. I want at least to relate to one, two, and six. Thesis number two is this relationship between class and ethnicity. I agree that certainly there is a relationship, certainly, but very often I think it's maybe more in the imagination than in reality. For instance, most of the Jews in Eastern Europe were not rich and not capital, were very destitute and poor. There was no real upper. The Tutsi, there was a bourgeoisie, there was an elite, but most of them were petit Tutsi, were poor, destitute Tutsi who were murdered. Certainly in the colonial cases, American Indians, there was even not an image that they were better off. So it doesn't work always. Now, it's difficult for me to agree that the perpetrators see themselves as exploited proletarian nations opposed to imperial exploiting nations. You correct me if I'm wrong. Now, that may be true, again, in the imagination, but not in reality, because certainly the Jews were not an imperial exploiting nation, the Armenians were not imperial, and the Tutsi were also not an imperial. Now, certainly it is true, and here I agree, that always economic and social conditions are very important, and they were also very important in Rwanda. Just before the genocide, the years before the genocide, the price of coffee, which was the main export, went down. The price of tea went down. The agricultural production went down. Export went down. GNP per capita went down. Poverty went up. Hunger went up. And density of density of population went up. And certainly that had an influence. We have seen in Rwanda that the militias, well, many of the killers were the Lumpen proletariat, really, of Rwanda. By the way, I think in that sense very different from the SS in Germany. Now, I don't agree that civilization played a role in Rwanda. In the book it says that the Tutsi saw themselves, and I'm quoting, defending the standards of civilized society. I really don't see that. And it says that the ideology of majoritarian democracy of the Hutu, which certainly is their ideology, was opposed to the ideology of Tutsi civilization. I really don't see here a symmetrical conflict between the Hutu and Tutsi. The rebel movement did not aim to establish a Tutsi state. The government aimed to maintain a Hutu state, but there was no symmetry here in both. And I don't think the Jews had any intention to preserve civilization in Germany. And by the way, I also don't agree with the remark, which is not basic to the book, that in the Israeli case, civilization plays a role. I don't think it has any role in the conflict. Now, back to Rwanda. It says that the Tutsi wanted the Hutu as a lower class, and the radical Tutsi wanted the politicide, which means, again, the concept, the liquidation of the political elite of the Hutu, as in Burundi. To tell you the truth, I don't see any signs that that was the intention of the Tutsi. I think that was really what the Hutu establishment said, or the Hutu propaganda said, in order to justify the genocide against the Tutsi. Now, I have also a point about ideology, but here I have now my doubts with the first speaker who said that ideology is emphasized. I thought that ideology is underemphasized because it says in the book, at least with regard to Rwanda, it is important not to overstate the significance of ethnic ideology in these two cases of cleansing. Now, I would argue that ideology is very, very important in Rwanda, the racist ideology. And I will recall shortly what this ideology said. In the colonial times, it was an ideology propagated by the Europeans about the superiority of the Tutsi, not the Hutu. And many, John Hennig speaks, Samuel Baker, Harry Johnson, Father Menard, and so on. Certainly all the now, after the colonial period, this racial theory was put on its head. And the Hutu, which came to power, regarded the Tutsi as foreigners, as Hamitic, foreign race, as Ethiopians, as a foreign race, foreign blood, as conquerors, as invaders, as tyrants, as murderers, as feudalists, and term which was very popular also during the genocide as Inyenzi. Inyenzi is cockroaches. And these cockroaches plays a crucial role in this, because cockroaches you kill. I have no problem of killing cockroaches, right? And such an imaginary pictures were also used with regard to the Jews. Now, for instance, the Hutu Ten Commandments of 1990, a basic ideological paper of the Hutu radicals. I just read a few. Every Hutu should know that a Mututsi woman, wherever she is, works for the interests of a Tutsi ethnic group. As a result, we shall consider a traitor, any Mututu, Mututu is one Hutu, who marries a Tutsi woman, befriends a Tutsi woman, employs a Tutsi woman as secretary or concubine. Or, for instance, all strategic positions, political, administrative, economic, military, and security should be entrusted to Bahutu. number 7, the Rwandese armed forces should be exclusively Hutu. No member of the military shall marry a Tutsi. Commandment number 8, the Bahutu should stop having mercy on the Batutsi. And number 10, any Mohutu persecutes his brother Mohutu for having read, spread, and taught this ideology is a traitor. Now, this racist ideology was propagated in the press, on radio, on television, in schools, in public meetings, in the churches, in speeches. And this had a tremendous impact. We can't understand the genocide in Rwanda without this. Just to give you an example how this leads to genocide, one of the intellectual leaders of genocide said 1.5 years before, they belong in Ethiopia, they the Tutsi, and we are going to find them a shortcut to get there by throwing them into the Nyabarongo River, which flows to the north, okay? I must insist on this point. We have to act, wipe them all out. And in April 1994, tens of thousands of bodies were floating in this river. So this was, by the way, a professor of linguistics who said that, okay? Now, I think also, sorry that I introduced your field, I think we can't also understand the Holocaust without race theory. I think maybe there is no Holocaust without Hitler, and no Holocaust without the SS, but there is also no Holocaust without race theory and racist ideology. Now, with regard to economic interests, I agree that very often economic interests mix are a factor. Certainly in the colonial cases, land is a very important factor. But even in the colonial cases, American Indians, Aborigines in Australia, I think racist ideology is very important. Only the combination of the both. I also agree, and that's certainly true in Rwanda, that greed, materialist greed, is very important. Many of the killers in Rwanda got things from killing. They got a business, they got a house, they got a cow, or they got... How many minutes? Can you finish?
Okay. Just concerned with the time.
Okay. I will say only 2 words about terminology and then I will finish. So that's, I don't get to see this number 6, although I think, I will say it, that initial intent is a very problematic concept, because what is initial? Is it Hitler 1919, 1923, 1933, 1938? I think the really important variable is it organized and planned or spontaneous? Now, in Rwanda, I have no time to expand on it. It was organized and planned. It was not spontaneous mass murder. Now, only something about the terminology. I thought that ethnic cleansing is expulsion up to now. And genocide is murder. And I have a problem here that the book, all the major chapters deal with genocide, but it's called Explaining Ethnic Cleansing. And then there are examples in the theoretical part where there was no killing at all. So it is, again, ethnic cleansing in the original sense of expulsion. So my question is if it would not have been better really to differentiate clearly between genocide, devote the book to genocide, and not to ethnic cleansing. Because if, for instance, ethnic cleansing as expulsion is a major feature of the book, then the biggest expulsion was Germans after World War II from Poland and Czechoslovakia. That should have been then a major case study, and it is not. So... I think I could talk now for half an hour about the terminology. I don't do it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'm just aware of time passing. I'm now going to call upon Michael Mann to the impossible task of responding to these various critiques, both general and specific. Michael Mann is Professor of Sociology at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, although from here, LSE originally. Apart from The Dark Side of Democracy, his other book publications include the first two volumes of Sources of Social Power, A Study of Modern American Empire, Incoherent Empire, and the book Fascists, which was published last year, and which in part serves as a preceding volume to The Dark Side of Democracy. And we have a few copies of The Fascists from Cambridge University Press, which can be looked at and even bought at a discount after the talk. Not, unfortunately, of The Dark Side of Democracy. Mick himself cannot even get a hold of more copies of The Dark Side of Democracy, even living at the moment in Cambridge, where it was published. But anyway, Mick, you can respond.
Well, I want to thank the three commentators, Sunisa, Benjamin, and David, and also to thank John for introducing the book. They presented many of my arguments. They made some criticisms. They know more about certain areas than I do, and I think I probably stand corrected on the Yugoslav federal institutions, and probably also on Eichmann's career. I thought he'd been a sergeant at Dachau and that the SD did have a Jewish section in 1935, but I'm sure I should read your book and be corrected on these things. Okay. I'm especially grateful to the early part of what Benjamin said, in that he explained fairly clearly the argument about the relationship between murderous cleansing and democracy, the dark side of democracy, and the confusion of the ethnos and the demos, the two Greek terms for people, which are obviously the antecedent words for all of our ethnic words and all of our democratic words. And it's the confusion of them in modern times that creates the special danger in which the various theses I discuss then add on. Now, I should stress that murderous ethnic cleansing is quite a rare phenomenon at the level that I talk about it, in terms of mass murder, cases of mass murder. And therefore, I'm not talking about the vast bulk of ethnic and national relations. And therefore, I'm also talking about relatively entrenched conflicts. Therefore, I am talking about, in response to something that Sinas has said, I'm talking about groups that are relatively formed and where identities have been, you know, these are not ancient hatreds, but I take care to say in the thesis, the third thesis itself, that these are quite old. That isn't a precise term, but that they are not new. They're not newly constructed, and many ethnic identities may well be more contingently created, and where relations rather than groups. I don't like using such general terms. I think it's very much a question of what phenomena you're looking at. I'm looking at groups where there was quite a strong sense of identity, not universal, which in certain circumstances can become activated into very dangerous and destructive acts. So this is just a small slice of ethnicity. And given that that it is quite a rare phenomenon, there is obviously a methodological problem, a kind of problem that sociology always deals with, that on the one hand, all situations are unique. On the other hand, human beings do confront similar problems, societies do confront similar problems, and there are some general processes at work which one can identify. Now, in this case, I'm talking about rare events. Now, and I advance a number of propositions about how one explains them. But I'm careful in all of the case studies to say that there are exceptions to all of these, and that no case perfectly exemplifies all of these propositions. It's a cumulative theory, the combination of the different things that I identify and make the outcome more likely, but no case is simply a kind of carbon copy of this general model. And I particularly concede that the Nazi extermination, principally of the Jews, but also the attempt of gypsies and other groups as well, that this is the most different kind of case in various ways. I struggle to explain it and to link it with various ad hoc auxiliary clauses to the thesis that I develop, but there is something slightly odd about an enemy that is so fantastic in many ways. I struggle to understand that through the identity of the Judeo-Bolshevik, which I think is the key identity, the key negative identity of Jews as enemies, which is connected to mass murder, and the Bolshevism is a fundamental threat to Nazism and is perceived as such by the majority of the party, by more of them who in the early 1930s who ever perceived Jews as a threat. But this is a very problematic to explain case. So to find little exceptions here and there is not a fundamental problem as long as they don't mount up too much. Okay. Let me say that as soon as one starts to get some criticism, some reviews, one realizes what the things that one should have said more clearly. One of the things that's in the book but is not brought out sufficiently relating to the perversion or the stalled democratization, the perversion of democracy, is that I do express this in terms of the careers of the perpetrators. That the vast majority of them, not most of the Nazi leadership, not Milosevic, not one or two others, but the vast majority of them start as seekers for a more constitutional regime, or for perhaps not for a fully fledged democracy, but for more a more constitutional regime than exists at present. And in their career, we see them passing from this reformist constitutionalism, sometimes democracy, towards the perversion of that in what I call organic nationalism, identifying the people with a national or ethnic group, and then finally with dealing with minorities or with others in a violent way. And it's that kind of career which is the kind of the core empirical part of the book in many ways. Now, I think that Armenia does fit this, John, rather than... Precisely because the Young Turks do start off in this way. And one should remember that they emerge in the Sultan's regime, they are a force for constitutional government, they are in alliance with Armenian nationalists until, well, we don't exactly know when, but certainly 1908, 1909, 1910, they start to have major disagreements, and the Young Turks are becoming more organic nationalists, 1912, 1913, and the break comes, and the Young Turks are clearly no longer pressing for a constitutional regime of any kind, and they are moving towards a very entrenched and Turkish notion of national identity rather than a more open Ottoman identity. And so this is the kind of thing that I'm looking at in more detail here. Now, on the second thesis, I say not only that ethnicity dominates over class, but that it rechannels class sentiments onto ethnicity. And what I make is a more universal statement than the proletarian imperial distinction, which does have some problems. Sometimes it's the proletarians who are exterminating, sometimes it's the imperials who are, but that doesn't fit all of the cases. But what I say is that if we find groups that are separate but equal, we don't have this outcome. It's the inequality between groups, and obviously there are the majority of Tutsi are poor, the majority of Eastern Jews are not wealthy, but nonetheless, the notion that Jews are exploiting us, that Tutsis did exploit us in the past, and if they return, they will exploit us now, just as they're doing, and this is perfectly true, next door in Burundi, and they still are, that these notions where sentiments of exploitation get rechanneled from class. It's perfectly true that in a better world, in Rwanda in the middle of 1994, there would have been a realization that by now it is Hutu elites who are exploiting most of the country rather than Tutsi elites. But nonetheless, the notion of exploitation has a certain plausibility. So that's the force there. As far as the distinction, David tried to make the distinction in the colonial cases. Well, he tried to make the distinction that he says that I should make the distinction between populist movements and governments and constitutions, especially in the colonial situation. And he says the colonial governments were often restrained, and it's a kind of it's the settlers on the frontier, the lack of government that leads to these things. Well, I do quote, if you want the frontier, I do quote the words of the first three governors of California, all of whom exhort the extermination of the Indians. This is a war of extermination between us and them, the first governor says, which will end with the extermination of them. And the second governor says that it must be a war to the death. And they set up funds, the State Assembly votes funds for funding militias who will be paid a bounty for every Indian scalp that they return. And so I think that actually in the colonial cases there's a clear distinction between the local settler governments and, in the first place, the colonial power, which is the restraining force. And then later, when we get the United States, and Washington is a long way then from the frontier, whereas I'm able to quote Jefferson Jackson, early presidents, urging on extermination, the later ones do not, apart from Teddy Roosevelt, because they're a very long way from the frontier now, and that government is seeking to restrain in certain ways, and Lincoln makes a compromise deal about, which I refer to, about executing Indians who've revolted. But the local governors, the local political system, is involved in this. I have problems with Jack Snyder, and I have a similar theory for half the way, which is that we do, both of us, stress the problematic nature of democratization, where you have two ethnic groups with plausible claims to political power within this arena. But then he gives a top-down explanation, which you tended to repeat. And I find that, and you continue to give a top-down explanation of Rwanda. And I think that's rather problematic. I don't quite see how these elites can actually mobilize large numbers of people as active perpetrators and vast numbers of people as passive bystanders unless there is something other than the interests of elites. I think that's the problem Jack Snyder's kind of argument. And I think one does this related to my later thesis that for this to occur, one needs some relationship between political elites, militants, especially those mobilizing paramilitary force, and the core constituencies of support down below for an extreme form of ethno-nationalism. And so that's what I'm trying to do in my model.
I don't think we're going to have time for questions. There simply isn't going to be time, so take a bit longer. We've made lots of points about your book, Mick. So I think it's best to hear you.
Right. The question of premeditation and the thesis where I say that that mass murder comes as a result from a kind of plan D, which results when plans A, B, and C are frustrated, and often it's not the same groups who radicalize. What happens as a result of the plans is that different groups come to the fore, more and more radical groups, and so we have something in the end that very few of them intended. I make a distinction between cases where there is, a logical escalation, and those where it's more contingent. A logical escalation is an example of Hitler. Given what he says in 1919, 1920, 1921, he wants to remove the Jews. He's clear and explicit about it, and if he comes to power, we assume he will try and do this, and this is consistent with everything he does. But there is the attempt to use violence within Germany. If we think of Kristallnacht and the like, that's meant to scare the Jews out, and you can make money out of them as they go. And not enough of them leave, so there's more escalation, and then there's Madagascar and other things, and then there's the war in the East. But I think, knowing what we know of Hitler early on, we would say that if frustrated, he might well go to this. Whereas I don't think someone like Milosevic had the slightest idea that he would be doing this. Now, this is very difficult to be certain about, and in the case of Rwanda is a good one. There are, and the literature is divided between people who see a fair amount of premeditation, as you emphasized, and those who question some of this. Now, let me say that I quote in the book the man who says the Tutsi should be removed to Ethiopia, and kind of the river offers a way of doing this, and I say that he had overstepped the mark, and he had to leave the country as a result of this. So you can find people saying these things, but what one doesn't know is the precise point at which there is a real plan. Perhaps if the Turkish archives are ever opened, we will know exactly when the Young Turk plan was developed, but we don't know, and we don't really know any of these cases except perhaps for the Nazi case. Now, I spend an enormous amount of time on that. Well, maybe not. I spend an enormous amount of time on the Nazi case because there's an enormous amount of research, and I did some myself on the perpetrators. And that's why it's a lot longer. There are very mundane reasons why there are different emphases in a book. Now, I'm a bit soft on communism, am I? What I try and do, let me subsume that within a remark about basic concepts. Is this a book about genocide? Well, most of the cases are cases of genocide, but not the communist cases, and not Yugoslavia, I would say, and not many of the processes which lead towards or are consequent upon genocide. So I spend a bit of time on looking at the antecedent conditions of the Armenian genocide, and one of them is the mass expulsion of Muslims from the Balkans as the Balkan states achieve independence from the Ottoman Empire. And there is a massive amount of deportation and a large number of deaths too. And what's become, I make tentative suggestions in the book, which have been reinforced by more recent research, that the perpetrators, the Turkish perpetrators, are overwhelmingly recruited from those refugees. And this is a theme of my book, that in general, refugees, people in threatened border areas, are much more likely to be perpetrators than others. So what I'm trying to do is situate genocide amid all kinds of other and lesser forms of ethnic atrocities. And I use the term ethnic cleansing both in inverted commas and without. Now, cleanse, what I produce near the beginning of the book, a two-way table. Degree of cleansing, degree of violence. Now, a group can be cleansed with no violence, cleansed in quotes, okay? Various of the groups, ethnic groups of France have been removed. And some of this process was through deliberate policies, but this was not generally done through mass murder. This was done through lesser forms. So one of the things that I do is look at the development of nation states in the West, especially in Europe, in terms of the elimination of other ethnic groups or the weakening of ethnic groups. I mean, people still have a Welsh identity, but there was a compulsory speaking of English in the public realm in the 16th century, and there were a whole series of policies that through the centuries meant that Welsh people became more and more assimilated to what was originally an English identity and then a British identity. And so these are some of them. And I want to situate genocide among much more broader processes, because genocide is so rare, it's difficult to understand in itself. But if one puts it in context of all of these other things, it becomes more explicable as part of the ethnic homogenization of modern societies, of most modern societies. I was going to say something else about concepts, and I've forgotten what it is now. When I stress, one of my theses is it says that it's a more dangerous situation if the weaker side gets help from elsewhere. What that refers to is that the normal outcome of a dominant majority and a weaker minority is that the minority submits to discrimination. That's the normal, the rational thing to do. You don't have the power to do anything else. That's what happens in 90% of such situations. What one needs to explain is why the subordinate group resists. And that is where the outside help comes in, or why some of the subordinate group resist. And this is the general pattern. Now, when I say that this is, when I'm criticized by David for saying this is a bit too favorable to the perpetrators, it's what they say. They say there's a Judeo-Bolshevik enemy, or that Armenians are collaborating with the Russian army. I prefer not to talk about the Judeo-Bolshevik enemy, which is highly problematic. But in terms of Armenians, there were some Armenian nationalists, and they're collaborating with the Russian forces, providing valuable information to the Russian forces invading the Ottoman Empire. And the Russian Empire had promised Armenians certain rights if they did help Russia. And Armenians had rather favorable view of Mother Russia, a common, also Christian, and perhaps helping them. It's when Russia is powerless to help them that the genocide occurs. Now, it doesn't require any particular. The Turkish view of Armenian nationalism is not a complete fantasy, and it's clear that nationalism is growing. It's clear that Armenians are going to be less and less willing to share a state with Turks, who are in any case beginning to regard themselves as a nation, and that there is a growing conflict with them. And so I'm trying to explain the perspective of the perpetrator in these respects, and that's what my emphasis is on, the perpetrators and not the victims. I mean, I think everybody has kind of understood, in a way, the overarching idea of the book, which is that this particular evil is not something alien and afar, but is in our own civilization. It's in our own historical civilization, and it's on the ideals that we have spread to the world. and Woodrow Wilson's confusion over national self-determination is a very good expression of that problem that we have created, first for ourselves and now for the world. But I'm glad that you quoted the last sentence. I think that if we do understand more of it, and I don't claim that my book is the last word on this, we will be able to do more about it. Thank you.
I apologise, but I'm afraid the timetable does mean there isn't time for questions, and I apologise for that. I'd hoped there would be. I want to thank you all for your patient attention to this debate. I want to thank Sinisar Milesevic, Benjamin Neuberger, David Cesarani for their cogent critiques of Michael Mann's book. But above all, I want to thank Michael Mann, A, for writing this book, and B, for being prepared to come here today to debate this book. Thank you. Yeah.